Don has been in the audio industry for over 40 years. His professional career began at Media Sound Studios in 1971, working up from the shipping department to independent engineer. In 1991, he joined Solid State Logic and today serves as Senior Vice President based in New York City. He has seen the introduction of many SSL's groundbreaking consoles, including the L300 and L500 Plus. So welcome, Don. Next to him in the middle, we have Bob Snellgrove. Bob started off life as an analog design engineer before everything went horribly wrong. Bob is the president of Gear Audio Distribution, a Canadian company, a distributor of professional audio equipment. Gear Audio have been the Canadian distributors for Digico since 2004. So I'll be speaking about Digico's designs. And then finally, we have Kevin Kimmel. Mixing since the late 70s, doing major world tours, doing both monitors and front of house. He's worked at Disneyland since 1981, mixing, recording, and as a broadcast engineer. Kevin has mixed countless TV shows since 1994, including several major award shows. Kevin did posts on films, including Raging Bull and Blue Lagoon, my two favorite movies. Since 2009, Kevin has been mixer, product manager, and systems application engineer for Yamaha Commercial Audio. So welcome to all of you. And we'll have Don speak a little bit first, and we'll go through each, and we'll hear from their views and their companies, and then we'll have some discussion, open up for lots of questions. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard. And thanks everyone who came here at the early hour. I'm Don Wershba, as I've been introduced here. It's a pleasure to be on this panel with these fine people from Digico and Yamaha, and what I'm here to do is tell you a little bit briefly about what's going on at Solid State Logic. I'm up on the screen. But first, topic is going to be current technologies, future developments. It's going to be very brief in the mortal words of Julia Child. I have one that we prepared earlier downstairs. And would invite you to come down and see the L500 that's there. But I thought that we would start with, hopefully you can see it, the three commandments of live sound. I can't take credit for this bit of wisdom, but I did want to pass it on. This is probably something that everybody knows. If you don't satisfy number one and number two, number three really doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it is important first that the reliability and the capabilities of the systems are satisfied. Now, SSL has two live consoles in its family. They were 3 years in development by a dedicated team to the live console. It was a ground-up project, so it was not taking an existing platform and adapting it. It did start from a blank sheet of paper. High-resolution audio was always part of that, so I'm going to get into some of the specifications. And of course, because these are going to be, you know, if you're lucky, they're in a fixed installation, but most of the time they're going to be banged around on the road in trucks and different temperatures and humidities and dust conditions, and we've been to the rodeo, as they say. So all of these things figured into what we were going to do and how we were going to design it. Now, the two consoles have things in common. They use what I would say a standardized engine, so there's a compatibility between the L300 and the L500. Both of them use 64-bit floating point engines. They typically will be run at 96K. However, we can now run them at 48K for broadcast applications. The stainless steel construction frame and the unibody construction was for torsional strength. It's an all-in-one system, so there are no external racks to run the console. The only thing that's external to that would be the stage boxes, which I'm going to show in a minute. There can be quite a bit of local I.O. and a tremendous amount of remote I.O. We use a technology that's called Blacklight 2, which effectively muxes and demuxes 8 MADI streams so that we can run 256 channels in each direction with full redundancy. The front end of the console, which is very important, is designed by the same designer who has done our studio console. So, in a way, it's bringing recording studio sound quality to a live console, making sure that you satisfy the very rigorous requirements of a live system and a mobile system, something that's banged around and set up and broken down every night. The high channel count, we've just increased that on both of our systems so that we're running 256 channel paths on the L500 and 192 channel paths on the L300. Again, talking about the standardized engines, it also means that if you start a setup on an L300, you can migrate it over to an L500. You can actually go in the opposite direction as well, because the software will allow you to then pick and choose if you've exceeded the limitations of an L300 to say, which channels am I willing to give up if I've exceeded the 192 channel paths that that can do. Few more things that all consoles have. Aux buses, of course, it's really down to the count. We can have up to 96 auxiliary buses, user selectable. STEM buses, which are akin to audio subgroups, but also have a great application for effects returns, and they're very economical, and they eat up fewer channel paths. I can go into detail downstairs if you like. Matrix, which does not eat into any of the channel path count, is a 32 by 36 matrix, which can be broken down into four sub-matrices, which makes it very convenient. It's great for distribution, everything that you would normally use. We've recently added VCA control and DSP processing to the matrix channels so that they become extremely useful as a distribution network. VCA control groups, we can have up to 36, which usually raises an eyebrow, like, why would you have so many? We have 36 faders on an L500 console, and there's no reason not to give you the ability to have all of those in a certain layer configuration to be your VCA control groups. 10 mute groups, two solo systems each with the ability to go to three different destinations. And then the last two, which I have in color, query and the layer manager, I'm going to go into a little more detail in this presentation, but again, I'm going to really try to keep this brief. So we'll have a quick look at the console from the front side. This is an L500, large touchscreen. Backside, you can see over here, it can be populated with a very generous amount of local I/O. For corporate applications where you just want to go set up the console, plug in and go, this can often be plenty, 32 inputs, 32 outputs analog, and up to 8 AES inputs and outputs. Pairs, I should say, 16 altogether. We're using fully redundant power supplies, as of course you would have to. That's not an option that comes standard. It is a MADI-based system. And so within the console's frame, you can have either coaxial or SC optical. We now offer both multi-mode and single-mode fiber options on the console. Over here, we have what's called the Blacklight 2. That, again, is the muxing and demuxing of 8 streams. Moving right along, the stage boxes come in a number of different flavors. They can be inputs and outputs in the same box. You can also specify them with electronically isolated mic splits on the back panel. That can feed, that's upstream of everything, which means that you can feed really a raw signal to a broadcast application or a recorder or whatever if you want for distribution. We also, do an AES box, which gives you 16 pair of AES inputs and outputs. Again, coming off the Blacklight connection, which I will show you next. So with two about 3/4 inch in diameter cables, very, very quick setup, you can do 256 channels up and back from the stage, and then they would distribute. You can see off the back panel, it just goes to a standard coaxial. And those are your breakouts to as many as 8 of these I/O boxes of whatever flavors you need. So that's the hardware. Now, there were two things that I want to show you. One is the layer manager. This is how you configure the console to operate in the format that the engineer is most comfortable with. You only have 36 faders, but you're going to have a far greater number of channels within the console. How do you want to arrange them? So here we see on the touchscreen that we're looking at the top snare mic. We go quickly over here. This is called the channel detail view. Within the channel detail view, all of the things that you would want to do with the channel input routing, EQ, dynamics, all the things that are contained in what we call a full channel. On an L500, you've got 208 of those full channels that are going to give you four-band EQ, high and low-pass filters, dynamics, gates, very comprehensive based on things that we've done in the studio, so external triggering, sidechain filtering, all of that is built in to those. We also give you a delay component to the channel, he said looking at his notes, and an all-pass filter, which please come downstairs and we can look at and talk about the all-pass filter. It's a facility that's not often found within consoles. Typically, it's going to be found in system distributions, things like lake systems. It's a great thing for fine-tuning the phase alignment of various signals. So after we've done all this, color-coded it, put the pictures in, put on the text, done all that, it then shows up in what's called the layer manager. Now, this is a screen within the console that says, I have sources, everything that's in the console. The console knows what's in there. I've got my destinations. And then down here is going to be the result of the organizations of that. So what can I do with that? I can take elements from my sources, five layers on every tile. Every layer has five banks underneath it. So the math tells you that you have 25 possible organizations per tile of how you want to do it. And the console does not doesn't care whether it's an input, an output, an aux master, a stem, a matrix, whatever. You can put a VCA group. So you can collect things in whatever is the most convenient way that the engineer wants to operate. So what can I do? I can take a layer and I can drag and drop it from the source to the destination. That will then take all of the five banks underneath that layer and place them in the right place. But I can also just take a bank, bless you, and I can bring that bank down, and then that'll just bring me down the channels that I have there. But what if I have something that's almost there, but not quite? Well, I can then take a channel or a group of channel or non-contiguous channels and drag them down there. So if in the middle of the performance you decide, oof, you know, it actually wouldn't be a bad idea to have the lead singer in this layer that I'm currently using that can have anything in it, you'd need only to have an empty space in this area, or you can replace it if you say, well, that, you know, the singer's more important than the hi-hat, so I think I'll bring that down there. That's how you would do it within the layer manager. So another thing to talk about is the channel detail view. In a full channel, you get all of these facilities just as part of the channel strip. Now I can see it. You've got a fader. You've got two insert points, an A and a B. You've got filters, EQs, gates, compressors, which are broken out separately. And then you've got your delay component and your all-pass. Now, you can see that these all have padlocks on them. That's because that particular channel is open. It's not muted. If I mute that channel, and I'm sorry I don't have a dramatic, animation for this, but it is again a drag and drop procedure to move those DSP components anywhere that you want. You can then unmute the channel, listen to the results. If you're not happy with it, you can mute the channel and move them wherever you want them to go. And that can be done on a channel by channel basis. So then we have the query function. This is a whole separate thing. What is query? Well, it's that little button there on the console. And when you query a channel, the result is everything that's associated with that channel path is now brought to the surface of the console. Now, what does that mean? That means if you like to work in VCAs as your main tile, and a backing vocalist who's on the backing vocal VCA is not necessarily on the surface of the console, you can drill down with a single button push and get to that component. If it's a matrix and you want to see what's feeding into the matrix, you simply query on the matrix. So the console's philosophy is, I don't really care what kind of a channel path you are, I will give you these facilities and these capabilities no matter where you are within it. So that's the present. Because I'm not at liberty to talk about what may be coming down 6 months or a year from now, although if you meet me at the bar, I might. What I do want to tell you is what has come out in version 3 software, which was released just this past month. Network I/O Dante, that's obviously something that we've talked a lot about at this. Dante is something that we are neck deep into. We have an entire division that just looks into the facilities of Dante. A Dante card and a Matty Dante bridge is available from SSL. That will allow you to tap into existing networks. And there's a lot more to come in that area because that's an area of tremendous development. Surface interconnectivity. I didn't talk about gain sharing or gain tracking, as we call it, but you can put an L300 and an L500 together, or two L300s or two L500s, and interconnect them. If you need more faders, we can even do sidecars with an intelligent interconnection between them so that you're just getting more faders. It's basically a console without a CPU. SuperQ, I'll show you downstairs. It's an enhancement of the query function, which allows both front-of-house mixers and monitor mixers to further customize the system, where you push a single button and a number of almost macro features happen, like the aux mix into the in-ears is brought up to the surface of the console. So the workflow and speed is very important. User-defined controls, again, instead of having to dig down through menus, you can push a single button, and you can bring up something that's within the system right up, and that's user-selectable. Broadcast monitor mode, if these are being used in broadcast applications, which they can possibly be, we've now adapted the Solo system to present what is more like a control room, typical studio control room environment. More effects, there's about 40 plus at this point. We also have the ability to bring in external plugins. We do not bring them into our operating system, which is a conscious choice. Happy to talk about that more downstairs, why we chose that path. We are finding that the effects that we have within the console are real crowd pleasers, and people are beginning to use more of what's in the console, which again speeds up workflow. Dry and effect mix controller, I just put that in because that saves you a channel when you're doing parallel processing. Usually you have to set up a whole other channel path. Now we simply put into, say like one of our brick wall limiters, we put in a mix control. So the mix control provides you the ability to do what had been the parallel processing requiring a whole other channel. I'm almost done. Online and offline software. We've had offline software for quite some time. Now we have wired or wireless control from a tablet or a laptop available to the console. Works very nicely, which brings me to my last slide, which is a picture of the two consoles. And that's it, and I hope I kept it within the 10 to 12 minutes that we needed. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm representing Digico here today. And I wanted to start by talking about the three most common blocks that you see in a digital audio mixing system: the work surface, the external audio engine rack, and the external I/O rack. I'm going to add to those three networking interconnections and provisions for plugins and recording. So I think if you're looking at a system, these are the five areas that you would be focusing on. I'm going to start in Digico land with the external I/O. So we make four I/O racks. They're different sizes. They fit within our line of work surfaces. So we have very small work surfaces and a very large work surface, so it's appropriate that there be different racks to go with that. Two of the smaller racks are restricted to 96 kilohertz operation, and the big SD rack, which I'm going to focus on, is capable of 192 kilohertz operation. So this is the back of our I/O rack. It has built-in FPGA processing, which gives it a number of capabilities which you don't often see in an I/O rack. It has some fixed facilities like Matty I/O, which are part of the rack. Of course, dual redundant supplies, very important. Optical I/O for connection to the network. And then the rest of it is modular, and we split the rack up into half I and half O. There are quite a number of modules. This is a pretty mature system, and so they range from from obviously analog input modules and analog output modules through to digital input and digital outputs. There's a sample rate conversion within the rack, which can be very helpful if you're operating at 96K, but you want to do a split out of the outputs at 48K for broadcast, or you want to split it out to MADI at 48K. So that can be taken care of within the rack. There's a USB connection to the rack, and the rack will interface directly with the laptop. So you can do a number of these functions with the rack, just with a laptop. Splits. We can take analog inputs or digital inputs, and we can duplicate them, split them to the other side of the rack. And one of the things that that's very handy in doing this is gain tracking. So we've heard a little bit already from Don about gain tracking, gain splitting. This is something that Digico's been doing for many, many years. On this I/O rack specifically, you can lock the output of the split so that any adjustments made by any of the consoles on the network don't actually affect the output level of the split, something that, from a practical point of view, very, very important. So that's the I/O rack. What am I doing here? Okay, so we'll move on now to our engine. And the SD7 features an FPGA-based engine. So it's a, as you can see, quite a powerful piece of technology. These numbers kind of speak for themselves. It's important to realize that this functionality is somewhat adaptable to what you're doing. We make three different pieces of operational software for the SD7, and the SD7 can be used in a broadcast application. So many live situations today are broadcast-based, or in live theater. So your West End, your Broadway, and the SD7 is a very popular choice on Broadway, mainly due to its capabilities, its size, but very specifically the theater software. So these numbers can be reallocated somewhat. For example, in theater, the matrix is much larger than 32 by 32. The auxiliary subgroup buses can be turned into stereo buses, and so can the inputs. So that's a little bit about the actual engine. It's a very fast engine. It's got very high audio resolution. It's a highly scalable thing. It's very small and lightweight. It has low heat and power consumption. It doesn't have a lot of, it doesn't have any component pieces to the engine that plug into it, which increases its reliability. It is built into the work surface, so it's actually not an external rack engine. That's, I think, a very nice feature to have in a digital mixing system, to have a smaller package to take out. One less thing to get rattled around. This is an actual picture of the engine. It's, I think, shockingly small. So we move from, we talked a little bit about the I/O, talked a little bit about the actual engine. We move now to work surfaces, probably the most key item, and the thing that is the interface between the user and the machine. And I think probably in terms of the future, the one area where most people will be interested and focused on how work surfaces work. So as I said before, the engine is built into the work surface. We've been using touch screens on live mixing desks for a long, long time. And really, Digico pioneered the use of a touch screen. It was a bit controversial at the beginning. But I think as time has moved on, as technology's moved on, we have brighter, higher resolution, more tactily reliable. We've moved into multi-touch. So there's a lot of nice things that can be done with touchscreens. It's like the old bank machines only a couple of years ago, where almost everybody walked up to that bank machine and tried to touch it. And so touchscreens have become ubiquitous in our lives, and we've been working with touchscreens for quite some time. We have a number of different ways of doing gain tracking. Again, gain tracking, something that's in Digico's DNA. The first console I ever saw from the company in 2002 incorporated one form of gain tracking, and that morphed into two. We now really have three variations of gain tracking to accommodate the needs and the requirements in a multi-console network. Alphanumeric display buttons that are multicolored, glass metering, videos built into the SD7, user programmable macros, again, something that were incorporated into an earlier console and have just grown. So the ability for a user to say, this is what I want the console to do right now, and to be able to program that on one button, find it quickly, know what it is, press the button, reconfigure the way the console operates. And in different forms, you're going to see this on all of the new offerings that are out there. It's a very important part of quickly and efficiently operating a live desk. In our newer baby console, there are four function knobs. So these knobs each respond to touch. They obviously turn their knobs. They can be pushed, and so you can confirm an action. They're lit, so they're lit with a multicolored ring. I've already spoken a little bit about specialized theater and broadcast software, which again is another part that reconfigures the user interface, and those also, you can have all that software sitting on one surface and bring up what you need when you need it. Not a real-time thing, but I think you know whether you're going into a theater situation or you're doing a rock and roll show. This is our smallest work surface. The side cheeks come off. It goes in a 19-inch rack. This is our largest work surface. There are three or four in between, different sizes and configurations. All of these work surfaces are very familiar to each other. They're very similar. I would say the variations are evolutionary changes on work surfaces, and I think it really is true to say that if you know how to operate the little SD11, that you would have very little trouble figuring out how to get the SD7 up and running. So this is our newest work surface. It's actually more than just a work surface because it's not an SD21, it's an S21. So it's really the beginning. I won't say it's the beginning of a series of new desks because I don't actually know if that's true. But it is something that is new. It still uses an FPGA-based engine. But it is a new engine. It's an engine that has just recently been developed, and the topology of that engine, the way it works, is a fair bit different than the SD series. And that was born really out of necessity. This S21 is a console that has many features, but it comes in at a very attractive price point. So this was a console that has the Digico DNA. It shares the same I/O, the same processing, that all contributes to the quality of the product and the sound, but it is at a different price point. Now we talk a little bit about networking. Back in 2001, Digico went looking for a networking partner. OptiCore 1 gig network was out there. It was adapted. It was used. And in 2002, the D5 launched with 160 input channel processing capability. Today, it's a 2 gig network. Lots of refinements in control and setup. It's almost a plug and play network. There's two redundant loops available on the SD7, and you can see what the channel count is here for just one of those loops. Each loop supports 10 SD engines, and in the SD7, there are two engines in the work surface. So you have a redundant engine as standard. Other desks in the line, you can add an external redundant engine if you wish, but this would mean 5 SD7s could go onto a loop, along with 14 SD racks. So a huge number of I/O connected to a large number of work surfaces. And sometimes you wonder if these are just numbers that we throw out to see who can come up with the biggest numbers, but there have been shows, and there are shows in prep right now, that have hundreds of channels involved in the shows. It's quite surprising. 500-600 channels in a live show. As well as the OptiCore-based big network infrastructure on the SD series, there are plug-in cards that take care of other standards that are out there. MADI is ubiquitous in everything we do. It's kind of the Rock of Gibraltar. These other things, are in addition to that. And on the new S21, we've gone to modular plug-in cards. You can have your pick of what you want to do. Recording and virtual sound check. Again, I separated that as a category. So this is typically via MADI I/O. We have external interfaces. They're inexpensive, and they allow you to, with a USB 2 port, directly take a data stream at 48 kilohertz. If you want to record at 96 kilohertz, you can do that with a different external box, cheap and cheerful. On the new S21, we built that right into the back of the desk. So USB to USB, and you're recording. And then plugins, touch briefly on that. Just simply, we add waves to a system. It's a plug-in card and a wave server, and you go buy your plugins, and away you go. So in terms of the future, I would say that from my view, and I think the company's view to a degree, bus count, number of channels, it's very important. It's getting bigger. Obviously, networking, it needs to be very reliable. You have to be able to trust it with your entire show. It has to be easier than some of the networking that we've seen out there. Everyone is looking for some kind of remote control ability to make their walk-around jobs a little bit easier. And the key, I think, for the future will be the user interface. Where does the future bring? Well, we're getting deeply into the technology, but the guys who are mixing, really, they're artists, and they need to focus on the show. And some of these things are taking away from their ability to do that. So that's, I think, where it's all going. And I do have a little sketch here, which is my last slide. And this is probably pretty much what the future of the work surface is going to be. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. But just to hear quickly from Kevin as well, and have a few minutes for sure for discussion afterwards. Kevin?
Yeah. I think I'll just sit here. I didn't put anything together on the presentation side, so I'm just going to do it all analog with a few notes. But as each of us, we've got consoles downstairs, so find some time, come on down. We're probably going to be pulling out, starting to strike around 2 o'clock because we've got some logistical stuff, timing to get things onto a truck. So come on down after lunch, if not before. So including what we have downstairs is the PM10, the Rivage PM10, which is our new flagship console. Yamaha's in its 26th year of doing digital consoles. Obviously, there's quite a reputation there. And I think one of the most important things and the biggest factor in doing live shows reliability, and Yamaha stands out there. And so we're going to continue that on with the Rivage series, and it is the first in a family or a new series of PM consoles and other components. So the PM10 consists of three main components. There's the mixing surface, there is the engine, and then there's the I/O box, RPIO 622. So the system on day one will be able to mix 144 channels. It's got 72 mixes and 36 matrix outputs. So the matrix is 72 by 36, but because inputs can go straight there, it could be considered to be 144 plus 72, whatever that is, by 36. There's 36 faders on the desk, and we'll get into the service a little bit more in a minute. On the I/O box, there's 6 slots of 16 channels each, and they can be combined with any combination of inputs, outputs, or AES cards. So 96 channels at 96K per I/O box, and we'll get up to at least eight boxes that you can do. So 8 times 96, which is what, 768 channels. Everything has redundant power supplies. Each of the components has redundant power supplies and 2 of the MY card slots. The MY card slots are the slots you know from the legacy of Yamaha. And there's over 30 cards that are available currently for those slots. The engine and the I/O box connect over our new proprietary network, and it's called TwinLane. It is the backbone of the system, and instead of thinking of it as a network, I think it's better to think of it really more as a backbone. And I say that because while it is a network, there's really not much to know about it. It connects with multimode fiber in a ring, so you have 400 channels at 96K and for full redundancy. And there's really not much to know about it other than connect your fiber properly, an input to an output. Don't put an in to an in and an out to an out. And within the console, you take inputs and outputs and land them onto the network. It gives you a channel count so you know where you stand with your 400 channels as you go. And there's really nothing else to know about it. There's no off-the-shelf products. There's no switches or anything. So there's really not much to know at all other than what inputs and outputs do you want to put onto TwinLane? So on the engine, it has like I say, 2 MY card slots, redundant power supplies. We've got new card slots, high capacity card slots. We call them HY, and they're up to 256 channels each. So on the back of the engine, there's 4 256 channels, and there's quite a bit of routing capabilities within the engine. So, on TwinLane itself, like I say, it's 400 channels at 96K with a latency of 12 samples. The connection between the engine and the surface runs on Cat5e or Cat6, and it's a proprietary connection. So while it uses a standard EtherCon connector, it's also proprietary, so there's no switches, there's nothing else to know there. It's also in a ring, so you have full redundancy there. It just basically you're running out of the console into it and out of it back to the desk. So there's really nothing more to know about it and nothing difficult to you have to know or learn about it. And the connection there between the engine and the surface is limited to 100 meters. So we figure most people will keep the engine with the surface, or certainly within 100 meters of the surface. So on the surface, you've got 36 faders plus your masters. There's three bays, a left bay, a center bay, and a right bay. Each bay's got a dozen faders. There's 12 different colors you can assign to the channels. There's a naming strip, of course. The left bay and center bay have 15-inch touch screens. Each section of the console has a home key, so at any time you could bookmark a page. So if you want to get to your lead singer, you know, channel, you can pull that up on the surface, hit a button, and anytime you need to get back to that, you can just push your home button, and it'll bring it up, and you can change that as often as you want. So if you want to get to a scene memory page, or you want to get to your patch page, or, you know, it doesn't matter, and that's independent per bay as well. There's there's also 24 DCAs on the system, and Each bay has 6 custom fader banks, actually 12 custom fader banks, so 144 customizable channels per bay. You can lay out however you want. They're scene dependent, so very easily you pull up the screen to choose what you want to put on a custom fader layer. If you choose to use a custom fader layer, you select the channel, it auto moves to the next one. You select the next channel you want to put there. So in a matter of seconds, you can fill up your custom fader bays or custom fader layers. One of our philosophies is we wanted this system to be very intuitive and easy to use. Anybody who's used a Yamaha console in the last 12 years, let's say, could walk up to this and very, very easily, very quickly, with very little coaching, be able to get around on it. We've taken things from PM1D, PM5D, DM2000, and even the CL series, and implemented them into this system. So there's some common threads that you'll recognize on the revised system. So it's quite easy to walk up and use. When you plug it in, you turn it on. It asks you which way do you want to sync. Do you want to go from the engine to the desk or the desk to the engine? You choose. It takes about a second, and you are online. It'll tell you how many channels of TwinLane are used, if you've done any patching to TwinLane. If not, you simply touch on the I/O box, and you can then just say, hit a checkbox. I want to put this slot, these 16 channels of inputs or outputs or AES onto the network. Same for your outputs. And it simply puts them on. It takes a matter of seconds. It doesn't cut audio. If you need to add something on the fly, you can do it on the fly, and away you go. And you don't have to. Everything shows up in every bay. So every channel, input, output, DCA, shows up in every bay. There's nothing to pre-program if you don't want to. It's really just land the channels onto the network and patch them to the desk. The patching is quite easy. It's a matrix or a grid pattern, something that you would recognize if you've ever worked on 1D or 5D. But it's I think it's a lot easier to use. You simply pick a beginning point. You can just scroll to auto-populate. You choose your range, and it'll put them in. So within within just a matter of minutes, you could be up and running and doing a show. The only thing you wouldn't have done at that point is name, but there's even some name templates in there. You can very quickly name, use a keyboard and mouse if you like, or you can do it on the screens. One of the standout things on this desk and this system is the sound. I think that there's a new head amp. It's our head amp. We call it a hybrid mic pre because we have, in addition to the head amp, at the tail end of the head amp circuit, we have modeled Rupert Neve's transformer. So, and that's in addition to silk and texture. So on every channel, every input channel, you can simply turn the transformer emulation on, and this has been approved by Rupert himself. So you can simply turn it on and make the desk sound very much like a Neve console by simply turning it on channel by channel if you choose to. And then you also have the option of dialing in texture and silk, either red silk or blue silk, to flavor how hard you want to hit it. You know, you can choose that. It's just a color and a flavor. There's a very large plug-in rack. We've got TC Electronic, a couple different TC Electronic reverbs, a number of the things that you know from our past, and all the stuff that's in the premium rack in CL series, as well as some new emulations with Rupert's signature for some of his vintage 70s EQs compressors, and also his 80s EQs and compressors, and we'll also have Eventide harmonizer in there at some point. So there's a brief overview. I would encourage you to come downstairs and take a listen, take a look. There's a lot of other features we can look at and explain.
Thank you, Kevin. So we've got three great consoles here: design, we've got versatility, reliability, flexibility. I'll start with the first question for these guys, and all three consoles are downstairs. I think that's been made clear, so we can look some more downstairs. 30 seconds from each of you. You're not talking about the future, as in 6 months from now, but what about 5 years from now? I'm a big fan of the traditional linear fader. Do you think we're going to hold on to that, for instance? Is that going away? We had a presenter here a year or two ago who was saying that audio engineering is going to turn into the CSI Miami, you know, moving virtual screens around and et cetera. But just very quickly, 30 seconds each to your vision of 5-10 years from now, console design.
Would you like me to start?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
We've often equated the console, and SSL has been building consoles for over 40 years, and somehow the fader, the linear fader, maintains. It is akin to a musical instrument, and while it is possible to create, say, a piano that has one black key and one white key and a knob, it wouldn't be particularly playable, and I think that, we have these things that we utilize. Now, whether we expand upon that or not is an excellent question. Now, the owner of my company is a well-known musician, a humanitarian, and technologist. And he has inspired the people who work for him to look at forward-thinking technology. So would we see something that would be virtual? It's very possible. We certainly wouldn't rule it out. However, we still all play the piano at the end of the day.
I think that the key is, as a performing technical artist, guys who mix the future and the present included, obviously the younger guys have a great love for toys and maybe gimmicks, but bottom line is it has to be about the live performance that's on stage. So an interface has to focus on the music and has to focus on what's happening on the stage and enable the guy who's behind the console, whatever that control surface happens to be, to pay more attention to what's happening on the stage and a lot less attention trying to find a high-pass filter. So my comments.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of tactile stuff as well, and it's hard to imagine just doing something on a piece of glass or working that way. Although we are working on something, and I see it being something like Google Glasses and heads-up display, and we're just going to call it osmosis. So it's not true. So it's hard to imagine not having something tactile for those of us that have been doing this for a while, and maybe it's less tactile. And how that gets integrated with some other surface that maybe we're currently not favored to working on. But you have to take the environment into account as well. What happens if you're outside? What if it misses, things like that. So there's other things that come into play. Or if it's, I guess it's hard to imagine being able to just do swipe and do these gestures and have something happen, because often that means there's something in front of you, right? And that means that you're not listening to your speakers directly in that case. So I see that as a problem that would have to be overcome. It's probably headed more in that direction than we would like to admit.
That's great. Should we open it up for questions? Anyone? Yes. Do we have a microphone, or could we? We could probably. Oh, we hear you fine. I think. Yeah.
For a long time, latency has been determined by converters that have symmetric aliasing filters, so you're typically looking at a couple of milliseconds into starting to see converters now that are asymmetric and much lower latency. Is that the norm? Is that what you guys are using now? And how low can we get latency through modern consoles now?
Well, I'll start by saying that going back 5 or 6 years, our latency through the conversion process was just a little under 2 milliseconds, and that was at 48 kilohertz. So that drops considerably at 96 kilohertz. It'd be nice if it could be zero. I don't think that will ever happen. So it comes down to where do the artists... it doesn't affect us in live sound in terms of coming off the stage and coming out the speakers. We've got other issues in terms of the network feeding through processors, through all kinds of stuff before it actually becomes an acoustic signal again. But we have major issues in terms of the monitor path, the guys who are mixing monitors. That's fairly significant. So a millisecond at the moment, a little bit less.
Yeah, I mean, I might add to that, there's the unknown, which is when you start putting external plugins, whether they be within the system or more relevantly outside of the system. And I'm not a heavy technologist, as you've probably all gleaned on that, but all that really matters is the singer with the in-ears going, I move my mouth and then I hear the sound, what's going on? That's really the ultimate judge of whether you're doing the job right. The cleaner the path, the lower the latency is going to be because the less stuff you have in between. The approach that SSL has taken is, let's see how good we can get it to sound without having to add extra stuff, so that you're not necessarily throwing a plug-in in because, oh, that's how I get a sound. Hopefully, it's like good cuisine. The raw material is really good. You use good ingredients. Now, people need plug-ins like AutoTune and things like that. All bets are off once that happens. But if you can at least present a system that presents a pure signal with the least amount of stuff between input and output, you are going to have the lowest latency and the happiest singer. And some singers can really hear minute latency. Thank God not all of them can, but some are tougher judges than others. One particular Nashville artist is always broad, said if it can pass the test of techs, then it's okay. So that would be the approach that I would suggest if you're looking to minimize latency. Use less stuff.
Should we just grab one more question? Perhaps Kevin could start with this another one more question before we move on. Anyone?
My question is there talk about eventually having a common language between show files between different manufacturers? That way.
Nope.
Absolutely, just not.
Just in the forums.
Why would you want that? No. It's a great goal. It's a great goal. I think I've commandeered the microphone.
Go
here,
ahead.
But I think what makes a Digico system, a Yamaha system, an SSL system desirable to the artist, otherwise it would just, we'd only have one kind of piano, to use that analogy. We don't have a common language. We all have individual things, and like OMF, how much of the stuff that's relevant is going to come across? And I think that would be an initial goal. How much relevant stuff can we get across? But I think it's a lofty goal to think that you'll get everything to come across. We do live in a capitalist society where you can do what you want and make your product unique so that you are the choice. But don't stop fighting the fight, because that is a laudable goal.
As a mixer, not live sound, I do recording mixing. I like jumping around from brand to brand. It keeps it interesting, and it keeps your brain young. And it's not, I don't find it that frustrating. As we've seen, they're fairly similar in terms of operation.
So it is a good thing that it didn't happen with analog tape, though.
I miss the smell of analog tape, personally. I think we better cut it off. I don't want to push into Buford's time too much, but as we said, the consoles are all downstairs. Further discussion can ensue in Worth later today. We've got a full a lunch break after the Solotec tour, so there's lots of time. I think they're all staying through lunch before packing up, so that'd be great. So I just want to thank all our panelists again, Don, Bob, and Kevin.